I'm a big Archers fan, and to be a part of it is terrific. I'm really enjoying it. I think probably any actor who comes to work on The Archers, who is a fan of the series, their biggest fear is that when they meet the actors in the flesh, they won't be what they imagined them to be like. That's the trickiest thing. Radio is radio. I adore working on the radio, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this. I think the only real thing that's so different is what John Telfer looks like now, because I did first meet him about 24 years ago, and since then the world has been God, I'm sorry.
Hear the secret lives of the folk from The Archers in Ambridge Extra on BBC Radio 4 Extra, Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 2:15, or catch up with The Omnibus on Sunday mornings at 11:15.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Well, now time for a little rousing hymn singing. The hymns from the Victorian age are distinctive, memorable and eminently hummable. But they have something else in common too. The vast majority of them were written by women. In this next programme from 2003, Ian Hislop goes to church now to decode the lives and the works of these remarkable but historically invisible ladies of song in The Choir Invisible.
We're in church. Think of it as any church in England, and you'll recognise the soft light and the musty smell, and you'll also recognise this sound. It's the unmistakable rustle of those ultra-thin, bone-dry pages of a hymn book. But flicking through these pages reveals an extraordinary fact. Most of the hymns that would feature in a list of all-time favourites were written by women. There is a green hill far away, once in Royal David's city, all things bright and beautiful, we plough the fields and scatter, nearer my God unto thee, in the bleak midwinter, at the name of Jesus, now thank we all our God, all glory be to God on high, just as I am. Most of the enduring English hymns were written within a few decades of each other in the middle of the 19th century, by writers who came from different backgrounds and belonged to different denominations, but who shared the fact that they were female. The church, of course, was largely dominated by men at the time, so it seemed appropriate to have a male presenter for this programme, and to start off with a male choirmaster. This is Robert Webb, director of the Christchurch Cathedral Singers, putting his choir through their paces.
Just as I am with all the
time. Let's just do that once again so the basses don't come in too early on that width.
Perfection is what the choir is aiming for, even in a hymn about human inadequacy.
One,
just as I am with all.
Just As I Am was a hugely successful hymn written by Charlotte Elliott in an age not known for its enlightened attitude to women. And she was just one of an extraordinary group of wonderfully named hymnodists, including Cecil Frances Alexander, Jane Montgomery Campbell, Sarah Flower Adams, Frances Ridley Havergal, Caroline Maria Noel, Anna Laetitia Waring, and Christina Rossetti. Why was there this sudden flowering of talent? As well as an Anglican choir, I'll be joined at various stages of the programme by a Methodist minister and two non-denominational academics. The Reverend Michaela Youngson is an ordained minister in the Methodist Church and a modern-day hymn writer. Valentine Cunningham is Professor of English Literature at Corpus Christi College in Oxford. Dr. Peggy Reynolds is reader in English at Queen Mary, University of London, and author of an anthology of Victorian women poets. I have just sung these hymns a lot and rather like them. Michaela Youngson, are you surprised that so many of our great hymn writers are women, given the status that Victorian women held?
No, not surprised at all. In fact, our hymn books probably don't show a fair representation of the women that were writing at the time, but that's probably to do with the fact they were published by men, and men chose the canon of hymns that were published.
So you think even the amount of hymns we have is probably grudging?
I think if you look through most hymn books, it's still quite a low proportion, although some of the best-known hymns and most loved hymns were by the women. In sort of feminist terms, we think of the domestic sphere and the public sphere, and it's always been hard for women to cross from the domestic into the public. And the church was a kind of third sphere where they could operate in quite a public role, while still in what was deemed to be safe and not fully outside the domestic.
So they could do Sunday school and the flower roster and these sort of
services?
Absolutely.
I mean, some of the Sunday school teachers of the last century were major, major influences on people who went into political leadership, into leadership in the church and into all spheres of society. So those women had a very strong role, but again, within a limited sphere.
Charles Wesley, back in the late 18th century, encouraged women to take part in church activities, and that climate fostered a succession of women hymn writers in the next century. Valentine Cunningham, why was Methodism and evangelism so important?
The evangelical movement is, of course, the movement of the warmed heart, yes? It is extremely affective, and Methodism, they always say, was born in song. It certainly was. And all the branches of Methodism are characterised by song. The primitive Methodists were dubbed ranters when they were caught singing through the streets of Belper in Derbyshire in something like 1813, group singing, speaking about personal religious experience of a kind of deeply affective sort, the religion of the heart. That was the great thing, the corporate expression of feeling. Now, of course, feeling is what women are supposed to be traditionally strong in, and there's no doubt that women caught on very much into the spirit of this new movement of affective singing.
So in the Methodist churches, women were playing a fairly active role. But what were the attitudes generally towards women in society at the beginning of the 19th century? Peggy Reynolds.
There was a marked change in attitudes and ideas about women writers from the end of the 18th century to the middle of the 19th century. At the end of the 18th century, there was a rise of what we can only describe as a kind of proto-feminist movement, writers like Mary Wollstonecraft, writers like Madame de Staël in France, who felt very strongly that women had a role in public life and who were demanding new privileges for women in terms of education, in terms of employment, in terms of family rights. But then, partly because of the effects of the French Revolution, there was a complete change around. The sight of women out, equal with men, on the barricades, demanding their own rights, was so terrifying that there was a kind of reaction and a sense of needing to get women back into the home. So that women were much repressed and moved into a different kind of arena, much less public than the one that they had in the late 18th century. And to some degree, of course, a new phenomenon rose up, which was that it was really something to have a wife at home, beautifully dressed, playing the piano, arranging the flowers, and that became a status symbol for a man who could show to the world that he had arrived.
But those women who were at home had to find something to do.
They certainly did. And one of the things that they could do was write.
But they couldn't preach sermons.
There is a problem, and that goes back to St. Paul and the prohibition against women speaking in church. The nonconformist movement in the 18th century did not endorse this, and for a long time it was entirely proper for women to preach. Part of this repression at the end of the 18th century meant that the Methodists, for instance, changed their mind and forbade women to preach any longer.
Right, and then the Anglican Church had never allowed them. So you had two lots of congregations of women without a voice.
Yes, but the sense of being able to write hymns because of the kind of proper feminine propriety and piety that went with both of those things meant that they were allowed to do it.
Catherine Winkworth was an extremely bright woman who found her outlet as a translator of hymns. More than any other single person, she was credited with introducing the German chorale tradition into England. Robert, could we have her praise to the Lord the Almighty?
Of course.
And what is the tune?
The tune is Lobet den Herren, which is a 17th century tune, and it comes from a thing called the Gesangbuch, which is a choral book for England from the 1800s.
Right, which is largely what she did, is turn German hymns into English ones.
This one's very suitable then.
Okay.
Praise to the Lord.
Catherine Winkworth was secretary of the Committee to Promote Higher Education of Women. Sarah Flower Adams, who wrote Nearer My God to Thee, was another nonconformist who was a friend of Robert Browning and was thought of by contemporaries as a radical. Peggy, can we speak of the Victorian hymn-writing women as being part of a sisterhood, some proto-feminist movement?
Oh, no, there's absolutely no doubt about it. The mid-1840s, 1850s, 1860s was a period when a great number of women were making early claims that would then feed into the claims of the suffragettes, for instance. And any number of these women were involved in running homes for fallen women, in refuges for women and children off the streets, homeless charities of this kind. Charities which would send people abroad, women especially, to make new lives. So there was a real commitment to actually bettering women's lives on earth as well as raising their eyes to heaven through their hymns.
These are very well-educated women, aren't they, Valentine?
Francie Ridley Havergal, she studied in Germany, she knew Hebrew, Christina Rossetti, she taught Italian, she wrote expertly about Dante, Anna Letitia Waring, she read her Old Testament in Hebrew. I mean, these were not, as it were, ignorant women. They were women, in a way, bursting with talent.
And this was the outlet.
The hymn-writing movement let them express that, not only their deep personal faith, but their theological and literary expertise.
You mentioned Anna Letitia Waring, a Welsh Quaker who turned to Anglicanism. She not only studied furiously, but also found time for good causes, like the Discharged Prisoners Aid Society. And she wrote 40 hymns. Robert, could the Cathedral Singers give us one of her best-known pieces, In Heavenly Love Abiding? Michaela, I know that your heroine as a hymn writer from this period is another very clever woman, Frances Ridley Havergal, the daughter of an evangelical vicar. What's your favourite of her hymns?
Take My Life and Let It Be.
And what number's that?
That's 705 in Methodist Hymns and Psalms.
All right, which I happen to have here. 705. Yes, there we go. Havergal, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my moments and my days, let them flow in ceaseless praise. This is the one where she's saying, take my hands, take my voice, take everything and take my intellect.
She was a very bright woman. At a very early age, she knew the Psalms off by heart. She knew all the Gospels off by heart. She read fluently at the age of 4 or 5. And yet she must have had so many restrictions on her, on her intellect.
And to think this was all being wasted.
Yeah,
it wasn't
absolutely.
Possible to believe
that. How could she be a whole person if she wasn't free to use these things?
It was not only their intellect that these women wanted respected. God and Christ are always depicted in their hymns as kind, forgiving, loving, inclusive, and respectful of what women can give. It's almost a metaphor for the way they think men on earth should behave and treat them. Do you think that's a fair assessment of the subliminal message, Valentine?
There is a sense in which Christ becomes a super husband. Frances Ridley Havergal, extraordinary verses which are clearly devoted but clearly erotic, even orgasmic, you might say.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let me quote. I am thine, O Lord, I have heard thy voice, and it told thy love to me, but I long to rise in the arms of faith and be closer drawn to thee. Very famous and well-known evangelical hymn by Frances Ridley Havergal. The chorus goes, draw me nearer, 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 blessed Lord, to the cross where thou hast died. Draw me nearer, 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 blessed Lord, to thy precious bleeding side. And that repetitivity, you find it quite a lot in these verses, and it is plainly erotic. It's a kind of eroticized devotion.
Possibly. Michaela, you're a modern-day hymn writer and something of a champion of women's rights in the church. Do you conceal subversive messages in your hymns?
I'm not conscious of that. I know the themes that come through my hymns tend to be more about justice and peace, and part of that justice for me is about issues of gender justice, that men and women, there is still an imbalance, there is still a need for us all to be freed.
And do you write about that in your hymns?
There are lines about justice and peace in pretty much
all of them. The phrase gender justice is quite difficult to find a rhyme for.
It's not a snappy line for hymn writing. But things about being all that we can be, all that we've been made to be. So that would be my kind of theme. And as I say, gender gets wrapped up in that.
And you think they were unable to address those themes, certainly head on?
I think they were not perceived to be active in the political arena, and that was the one place you could get things changed. But they were very active in terms of things like operating in missions to prostitutes, missions to the poor, missions to children. Women would have a role within that, often seen as secondary or subordinate to the men who were in charge. So you might have deaconesses working with the poor, working with the sailors or whoever it might be, but usually some chap over them telling them how to do it and what to do.
Someone who I suspect would not have thought of herself as subversive was Mrs. Cecil Frances Alexander, the wife of the Bishop of Derry and Raphoe. She ran homes for fallen women, visited the poor and sick, and developed a district nurse system in Derry. However, she was no radical. In fact, one verse of her most famous hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful, is now considered so politically incorrect that no one ever sings it. So, Robert, could we have just that verse? It off there. Mrs. Alexander was a rich woman in a bishop's palace and was at the top end of the Victorian social scale, but she was still an amazingly prolific and successful hymn writer. Valentine, what was her secret?
She writes a volume called Hymns for Little Children to illustrate the creed for children. Well now, the creed, Maker of Heaven and Earth, its subtitle is of course All Things Bright and Beautiful, or Who Was Conceived by the Holy Ghost, Born of the Virgin Mary, that's once in Royal David City, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead and buried, there is a green hill far away. Now these hymns are written, they're written essentially for Sunday school. They're written for woman's domain, traditional domain in the church. But my goodness, they're so super. They come across into the main church, as it were. And one might say now, I mean, Christmas, what's Christmas without once in Royal David City? Yeah. What's Easter without? There is a green hill far away. I mean, that's a characteristic sort of thing. Here's the woman who is deeply preoccupied with traditional women's area of Christian activity, the Sunday school. The proceeds for her hymns for little children went to a school for the deaf and dumb in Northern Ireland. They are so wonderfully, I think, animated by what you might call the religion of the warmed heart, this personal religiosity, that the force of their writing, as it were, sweeps away male resistance.
But the fact that she originally wrote these hymns for little children makes people think they're a bit soppy. Do you think women hymn writers deserve this reputation?
There is an extraordinary sort of toughness to these women. They aren't wimps at all. I mean, Mrs. Alexander wrote poems for the Orange Order of Northern Ireland about how they're not going to stand any Fenian nonsense and so on, what's a true orange man about and so on.
Part of this perception of weakness, Mrs. Alexander apart, may lie in the theme of powerlessness, which often occurs in these women's verses. Christina Rossetti is probably the most famous name in the whole group. She was part of the Pre-Raphaelite movement and known as a poet as much as a hymn writer. Michaela, do her hymns point to this lack of power and influence?
She wrote In the Bleak Midwinter, which is a beautiful hymn, and something very moving about the verse, what can I give him, poor as I am?
If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what can I give him, brackets, I'm just a woman.
Yeah, that's what I've got to give. And I think many Christians, male or female, have found that moving, and that we all have something to offer and something to contribute. But clearly she's not a shepherd, she's not a wise man, She is limited in her scope as a woman. Mm. There are limits on what she can do, and yet she can still offer something to God. She also talks about the way that all Mary can give Jesus is a kiss, and there's something very precious and loving. And you could say soppy, but her poetry is too good to be called soppy. I think she puts it very well and very beautifully.
And that is not a sentiment you think that would have been produced by a male writer?
I think not. I think there is something about someone who understands motherhood in that sentiment.
So it's maternal, not from a distance, but from
yes,
the inside,
absolutely,
as it were.
Yes. This is an intimate, a real experience, something about relationship rather than being a spectator.
There is, though, a sadness about some of these hymns. Christina Rossetti died in 1894, an unhappy woman, unmarried and unfulfilled in her own eyes. And many of the women we're talking about were what the Victorians would term invalids. Rossetti suffered from neuralgia. Charlotte Elliott, author of the first hymn we heard, Just As I Am, became ill in her 30s, lamenting in her diary, "What it is to fight day after day, hour after hour, against bodily feelings of almost overpowering weakness and languor." Frances Ridley Havergal had a skin disorder. It's something of a theme, isn't it, Michaela?
I looked at a book from 1892 called Lady Hymn Writers. Awful title, but a very interesting book. And so many of those women were what were described then as invalids. You know, we wouldn't use that word now. Now, whether some of that was... Some of it clearly was physical, but I think for some of them it was probably the psychology of actually not being fulfilled, not being able to be fully who they'd been created to be.
And you think that had sort of driven them into... The Victorians would have called it hysterics, wouldn't they?
I think possibly. I mean, it's very interesting. Charlotte Elliott, who wrote Just As I Am, she had originally begun to get on very well in high literary circles. And the book that I was referring to talks about the way that she was, her illness when she was converted drew her away from these snares of the world and allowed her to write for God, which again is about, you know, what's acceptable writing, and that her intelligence could have taken her a very long way.
But it would have taken her away from
the church, from faith, from being able to express her faith through that kind of means.
Peggy.
I'm afraid it's a condition of Victorian womanhood a lot of the time. You would get headaches and be really fed up if you couldn't go out and do real things in the world. I would.
So you think it was all repressed ambition?
Yes, I do, actually.
Fair enough. But however frustrated they were, they won a posthumous victory. Their feminine hymns have become ingrained in the Christian mainstream. What did the band leader on the Titanic choose as the last music that the passengers would ever hear? Sarah Flower Adams' Nearer My God to Thee. And there's a similar nautical example, isn't there, Michaela?
There's the hymn by Priscilla Owens, Will Your Anchor Hold in the Storms of Life, which very much fits in with the theme of things are rough around us. You know, there's storms blowing all around
right.
us. Are we fastened?
689, I'm just going to get there.
Good. Are you fastened to the rock which shall not move? You know, there's one thing in life that she could rely on. And it's fascinating that this woman's hymn, which I guess was probably written for a Sunday school, is now the hymn that's adopted by the Boys' Brigade as the Boys' Brigade hymn.
Right, so she is getting a chorus of young males to sing her thoughts.
She absolutely is, and to wear an anchor as their symbol and their badge. So even 100 and however many years after she wrote this hymn, lots of young lads are singing her words.
That is quite an achievement, and in its way, genuinely subversive.
Oh, I think so. I think this is deeply, deeply subversive. I think it's a kind of subversive strain which I doubt if men wholly recognised at the time, and I don't think they even recognise it now as having really happened, that within the heart of this great male machine, as it were, there is this body of women worshippers who are providing the words of devotion.
D.H. Lawrence wrote an essay called Hymns in Man's Life, typically being a man's life. But actually, what he's describing is the power of the emotional vein of those words and texts for him.
Indeed, sir. He's read everything. He's read Shakespeare, he's read Dante, he's read everything that matters in the canon. But still, the words that most move him are the hymns from Sunday school. And he meditates on that. No poetry more potent. No poetry more potent. But of course, many of those hymns which he talks about, hymns in a man's life, were actually provided by women. So you might say what was really moving him was, as it were, women's hymns in a man's mouth. Women's hymns in the mouths of all the Christian church. Hymns from a woman's life, now in a man's life.
Peggy, Do you think anyone at the time had any inkling of the success of these writers in posterity?
There are ways in which some of the more sophisticated writers knew what was going on there. And here I'm thinking particularly of a poem, actually, by George Eliot called Oh, May I Join the Choir Invisible. And it seems to me here that one of the things that she is thinking about is the fact that there is this long tradition of women hymn writers. So it begins, Oh, may I join the choir invisible of those immortal dead who live again in minds made better by their presence. And it ends by saying, so shall I join the choir invisible whose music is the gladness of the world. So it's almost as though she's recognizing that there is this long tradition of women hymn writers, but what she's actually writing is a kind of pantheistic hymn about how eventually her soul, along with everybody else's striving, ardent, favourite word of George Eliot's, souls, will be reincorporated into the whole world and make the world better.
This choir invisible really does deserve to be a bit more visible. As women writers, their work is arguably the best known and best loved of the whole Victorian period. And as hymn writers, they've provided texts of faith that have proved a lot more lasting than most sermons or speeches. As individuals, they've been largely unsung, which is unfair, because this has never been true of their extraordinarily popular and enduring hymns. I think probably the last words should be a woman's. Those of Christina Rossetti.
Yes, don't panic, Christmas is behind us. But that was Christina Rossetti's In the Bleak Midwinter. Ian Hislop was uncovering the truth about the hymn-writing ladies in The Choir Invisible back in 2003. The producer was Philip Sellers. Next week, fond memories of Lionel Bart's Twang and other fabulous flops as Paul Roseby investigates the disasters of British musical theatre. Now, as I'm sure you know, only here on 4Extra do we offer you a chance to go a little deeper into the everyday lives of the country folk from The Archers. Alan Franks, Ambridge's vicar and husband of solicitor and salsa-dancing Usha, is finding life pretty tough at the moment, and that's before he has a chat with his archdeacon about a neighbouring cleric.
I saw the archdeacon this morning.
What did our Rachel have to say?
Well, somebody wrote to her.
Don't tell me. Aubrey Shawcross.
What, he knew?
Oh, just an educated guest, chair of the PCC. He knows how things are supposed to be done.
Right.
And that's how the good folk of this parish like it and how they want it to stay.
Well, things are about to get a whole lot trickier for all concerned in Ambridge Extra on BBC Radio 4 Extra, Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 2:15, or catch up with The Omnibus Sunday mornings at 11:15.
Hello, Grace Dent here. When I was a child, I held two ambitions. One was to travel through time. And the other was to be crowned Radio 4 Extra's comedy controller. Looking back, the latter seemed more ridiculous, as digital radio hadn't been invented and 4 Extra wasn't even a hint of a glint in Auntie's eye. However, this weekend those dreams will become a reality when I'll be firing up my flux capacitor and visiting some of my comedy favourites past and present, including the likes of David Sedaris, Laura Solon and Mickey Flanagan. So join me, Grace Dent, this morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 for 1.21 gigawatts of timeless tomfoolery here on Radio 4 Extra. It's your kids, Marty! Something's got to be done about your kids!
I don't know why I bother.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Grace Dent is our comedy controller in an hour's time. Before that, on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, it can only be Garrison Keillor. And any moment now, we'll be joining him over in Minnesota. While at the other end of the day, we bring you one old house, one cheery all-American family, and one very frustrated ghost doing his best to kick them out. Alistair McGowan reads The Canterville Ghost tonight at 6:30. Now, though, with ghostly porcupines, problem skunks and the staggering news that food is bad for you, here's Garrison Keillor in a show first broadcast in 2010.
Oh, hear that old piano from down the avenue. I smell those roses, I look around for you. Oh, my sweet, sweet old someone, coming through that door. The band is playing, I feel like staying. Honey, could we ask for more?
Coming to you this week from the Mayo Civic Center in Rochester, Minnesota, it's Garrison Keillor's radio show, produced by Prairie Home Productions and distributed by American Public Media. With this week's special guests, jazz songbird Inga Swearingen, Nashville picker Guthrie Trapp, vocal trio Sweet Dreams, and Minnesota polka legends Ray Sands and the Polka Dots. Also with us, the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Sue Scott, and Tom Keith, the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, and the news from Lake Wobegon. Today's show is brought to you by Jack's Auto Repair. All tracks lead to Jack's, and if it's not broken, we won't fix it.
Oh, it's such a great occasion to have a band that has band desks in front of them. Band desks, professional band desks. We play at ballrooms all over southeastern Minnesota and all over Minnesota and all over the Dakotas. They've been playing together for years. And please welcome here on the accordion, Mr. Ray Sands and the Polka Dots, the Minnesota Polka.
One, two.
Underneath the trees, the Minnesota polka, the rippling waters play.